Hello out there in internet land, and welcome once again to the Dungeons & Dragons podcast. You see before you three podcasters clustered around a bank of four microphones. The fourth microphone would normally be occupied by Michael Robles, but he is not here today. He's out sick. So I am your Dungeon Master cum host for our podcast. I'm sort of tempted to present this as a D&D session where I can narrate what you see and what each person's doing, but I think that would just get pretty irritating after a few minutes. So we'll drop that idea and instead head straight on to the meat of our podcast here.
We're still going to roll initiative to see who gets to talk, right?
Yeah, exactly, okay, right? Excellent. Turn by turn as an action. You can speak for 6 seconds, then I must stop. So it's like if someone's saying something really interesting, like they talk for 6 seconds. Oh, I do nothing. I pass this turn. Okay, now right. So with me is Rodney Thompson.
Hello.
And special guest star this week, Chris Dupuy.
Hi.
You sound a little nervous.
That was a little nervous. I don't normally do the podcast. I got the invite like an hour ago, so.
It's not. We're not going to bust out the Mask of Valor or anything like that.
No.
Do you guys know the story of the Mask of Valor?
I do, but I don't know if Chris does.
I don't.
So do you want to tell the story? Or do you want me to tell the story?
You can tell it. Go ahead.
So and I'm telling this like fourth hand now. So this is a story from the days of TSR.
Yeah, because neither of us were there, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, I would have been pretty young. That's why I would have a little child labor law violation. So this is back from the story of the days of TSR, back when apparently hazing laws had not yet either existed or extended to workplaces.
Right.
And physically abusing coworkers was cool. Like, it's like the 70s, and it was just like there were no laws yet. We had just evolved out of, like, Wild West times.
Right.
We'd had a World War II.
We were in the 70s.
Yeah, then suddenly it's the 70s, and people are like, oh, crap, we need a society, so let's make one up.
I'm going to guess you were born in the 70s.
I was born in the 70s.
Okay, so basically everything before the 70s, you just have no concept of it, right?
I like to think of the 70s as the last decade where, like, smoking and drinking while you were pregnant were A-OK. No one really cared.
Right.
And
it wasn't actually a health risk.
Yeah, exactly,
something
right?
Changed.
It was just a way to be cool.
It was just a way to be cool. Because you're worried if once you're pregnant of getting that cool kid cred by smoking.
Right.
Anyways, meanwhile, the Dungeons & Dragons podcast, the Mask of Valor is apparently when they would hire a new person to the design department, they had this fencing mask. And if you haven't fenced, basically, it's a mesh wire mask with a very, really fine mesh to make sure like a foil does not sneak through and it could kill you. Like people have been killed in fencing incidents.
Right.
It's very uncommon, but it has happened. You are, after all, stabbing someone with a long piece of metal.
Right.
So without the proper safety gear, you could be badly hurt. So apparently what they would do is they would tell someone, look, it's your first day. It's time to don the Mask of Valor. They'd put this fencing mask on someone and tell them they're going to throw darts at the fencing mask.
Yeah.
Now, the thing with the fencing mask was, since it has this mesh, the dart would hit the mesh and stick in, but it wouldn't actually reach your face.
Right.
So that was, they'd get whatever, they put the mask on this guy. I think they'd blindfold him or something too, or whatever.
Right. Well, you know, you want to protect their eyes just in case a dart gets through.
Yeah, just in case a dart gets through. But apparently they would just throw like fake darts or
wadded up pieces of paper or stuff like that.
I'm sure I've mastered the story. There's probably some guy, someone who worked at TSR right now is very mad that I've ruined the story by not.
Yeah, Steve Winter told it to me the first time and, we could have just gone and asked him.
But we probably should have just opened the door to this office.
He's we'll literally right 50 feet from us right now.
In real
now.
Time. So, Rodney, I see that you have before you a copy of the latest Dungeon Command set.
Yes, I do. It's the Blood of Grimsh set. It just came out, in fact.
So you and Chris worked on this, right?
Chris and I both worked on it along with Peter Lee.
All right. What's interesting about it?
Well, so one of the most exciting things about it is this is the first of the Dungeon Command sets that features all new miniatures. These miniatures are of, obviously, orcs, and there's an ogre and an owlbear and a boar and a werebore. But all of these miniatures were created for this set. And they're actually, we used a process that was new to Dungeon Command on this one where we created a baseline orc and then outfitted that orc in many different ways to create these miniatures. So it's one of the first times where all the orcs in this set or all the miniatures in this set come from, or many of the miniatures come from a common model. Which means that they all look so much more alike than any other two miniatures previously. It really gives these guys a feel on the when you put them down on the Dungeon Command board, these all belong together because they were really created to work together. So that's one of the more sort of interesting and exciting things about these is that this is a set that was really engineered from the ground up for to be a cohesive team to work together visually. I mean, and of course, like all of our sets, they work together mechanically. Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about the mechanics behind the orcs?
Yeah, the orcs work on an order deck that's built of strength, constitution, and wisdom. So because of that, they will feed back into some of the other sets that have used those order cards as well.
Yeah, finally that dwarf cleric from the very first set, he's finally coming into his own.
You know,
he did get a lot from the last set too.
True, and he's been very popular. He was one of the most popular ones out of the first set, right. And I was surprised by that.
Right.
You know, we were all about the Dragon Knight and
right.
The dwarf healing all the time. Everyone loves him.
Yeah.
But yeah, the orcs are, they're really hardy. They can just take hits and keep coming at you. And because of the boars and the druid, there's a lot of wisdom in the set. Mm-hmm. So they've got some surprising tricks up their sleeve when you feel them on the battlefield.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more straightforward set than, say, like the undead, which mess with your graveyard and have a lot more attached cards and stuff like that. These guys, I feel like they are really good at hitting you hard and living a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, it's a pretty simple thing to manage, but at the same time, they do it in a lot of interesting ways. So I think the orcs really satisfy that big bruiser feel that you get from individual monsters in other sets. I mean, like the Horn Devil is a great example from the Goblin set, that's sort of that big bruiser type. This is sort of a set full of nothing but big bruisers.
Yeah, they just keep coming at you, and it's a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, and the Constitution, really this is the first time we've used a lot of Constitution. I guess we had some in Undead.
We had some in Undead, but yeah. It's been fleshed out a little bit more here.
Yeah, so you're really going to, I think the Orc set is really going to augment your Undead set. You'll use the Strength cards with your Hero set, and of course the Wisdom cards as well. I think that this not only rounds out the other sets well, but also you're going to want to pull in cards from those sets to even further crank up your orcs.
And now that this sets out, I feel like we have finally enough order cards in the pool that we can really start fielding a con army, a wisdom yeah. army, and you can really start to make constructed warbands that are exciting and really have a specific strategy as you're playing.
Yeah, we were talking before the podcast started about, okay, all right, we finally got our sets in. Now it's time for us to start playing some more constructed. So I think that in the next couple of weeks, this will become a regular lunchtime game for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about it.
Especially with the orcs, right? I mean, actually, my favorite figure in the new set, and I'll actually go around and ask you guys this too, but my favorite figure in the new set is the ogre. And the ogre is actually based off of some of the concept art that we were doing for the next iteration of the D&D role-playing game. But I just really like this guy because he looks big and brutish, but he doesn't look slovenly or cartoonish. He just sort of looks like a big, oversized, muscular orc in a lot of ways. And I really like the way this guy's proportioned. He's got an axe that is bigger than most of the miniatures in this set. So I'm really a big fan of this guy.
And if I remember correctly, all of the designs for these CAD sculpts came from our work on the art for D&D Next, right?
It's everything but the owlbear. The mm-hmm. owlbear is still using an older style.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But otherwise, the orcs and the ogre and the werebore and everything, they're all based on the concept work we've been doing with the art department to set up a cohesive world in D&D Next and have everything look similar.
All right. So also new on the sort of delivery truck, we had the reprint of Unearthed Arcana.
Yes.
So that was essentially the really big rules expansion to AD&D First Edition. So it was notorious for two things. One, and I say notorious, I mean these are like the downsides. Let's start with the downsides. At least as a D&D fan back in this game.
Yeah, you want to build
because that's how you want to pitch something. Let's start with the negatives.
Well, they're actually negatives that will become through the magic of modern publishing positives.
That's right.
So first, the binding was notoriously terrible. The
books
fell apart. I don't think I've seen an intact copy of Unearthed Arcana, first edition. Second, there was errata printed in Dragon. So that was always, like, even as a kid, remembering, oh yeah, you have to make sure I forget what Dragon issue it was, but make sure mm-hmm. you have that issue, and you need to stock it right next to your copy of UA. But, look, this is my thing now, in the new version, it's corrected, so we've got new binding, mm-hmm. same quality as the AD&D reprints, and plus we have updated, we went back and applied the errata, so this is like, let's see, how many years ago did this book come out? 28 years later?
Right.
God, I feel old.
Finally got the errata in.
Yeah, yes, we've added the errata, and it's a corrected printing, so it's also, I have to admit, I really like the cover design.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty cool, with the gold leaf on the corners, a piece of the original artwork, the wizard peering over his book, and on the if you look at the spine, there's little symbols in gold mm-hmm. along each spine. So each of the four now AD&D rule books has a different sort of little symbol signature thing of the spine.
Yeah, I was really excited to get our office copies of this because as a result of the old binding being so fragile, I had never been able to get my hands on a copy that wasn't completely destroyed, right? So getting these new office copies has been big for me because, A, I never had one previously. And then, you know, it's a nice premium product.
We put a lot of work into relaying out the book, capturing mm-hmm. the text, trying to capture the art. It turns out they didn't have digital versions of these books back right. in the 80s. One thing that I find really interesting was when you think of Driss Duerden, our iconic Drow Ranger, he is actually a fully legal AD&D character.
That's like, right.
Making a Drow Ranger, according to Unearthed Arcana, was not weird or bizarre or strange, because by the rules, I'm looking right here at my character race table one, character class limitations. And if I look down at Ranger and look across to Drow, dark here in this table, I see a yes. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. I've never asked Bob Salvatore about that, but I always kind of wondered, did he just open up his rule books? Because when you think about the Companions of the Hall, you have Wolfgar, who's also a barbarian,
right.
you know, and that's, so I wonder if he was thinking, well, it's a barbarian character class. Mm-hmm. It's also where the Cavalier showed up, Thief mm-hmm. Acrobat. Right. And it was pretty nifty at the time, though it did have a reputation for increasing the power level of characters. Right. And I don't think that really, I don't recall there being like a feeling that monsters were getting more powerful or adventures were getting tougher. I think it was just, these just seemed a little bit like a power up.
Right.
So it's kind of, it was kind of divisive back then, like whether you embraced it or not.
And like you say, it's one of the first books that really expanded the rules of AD&D a lot. So, I mean, that was just a big cultural thing. It's like, oh, here's new rules for this game.
So speaking of reprints, we also announced that we are doing a reprint of the original Dungeons & Dragons set, the Fabled White Box.
It's right, a premium reprint.
Have you ever played D&D using those rules?
What did we use when we went through our big tour de force of all editions?
We did play that game.
Right.
We did.
Okay. So yeah. Because I'm definitely a child of second edition. That's when I started playing. So I didn't get to use those the first time they came out. But for those who haven't heard this, I was mentioning it on the podcast before. One of the things we did in the ramp up to the start of design of D&D Next is we started out by playing every edition of D&D. And of course, the first one we started with was apparently White Box ODD. I only know that because you ran it.
Yeah. So. It had the very like straightforward. I mean, well, the rules looked simple because I read them and figured them out. They were confusing. I mean, now, to be fair, this is the first time anyone had written a role-playing game.
Right.
So it wasn't like they could just pull a book off the shelf and use that as a starting point.
And in fact, it was the first time many people had played a role-playing game.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
It's not like, you know, oh, yeah, I've played plenty of these kinds of games. I could design my own. It was inventing an entirely new genre.
Oh, yeah. But the idea, the core idea shines through. It was interesting running it and playing it because, mm-hmm. to me, it captures the essence of a role-playing game, which is just you're depicting a fictional character
right.
in a world, and there's a player, the dungeon master in this case, who adjudicates the world, and just the game knows that it can't possibly cover everything, so it lets the DM has to create stuff.
There's a lot of letting the player and DM figure things out, and it took me a while, because I'm very used to, you know, modern, even, you know, calling second edition AD&D modern. I'm used to more modern role-playing games, which are very detailed in the rules and the rules are laid out very precisely. And there were a lot of times where I'd be reading through the white box and I would say, wait, what die am I supposed to roll here?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't actually understand that all the weapons just use a D6.
Yeah, just use a D6. Right?
And so it took me a while to figure out, oh, okay, every weapon does 1d6 damage.
And it's interesting how roleplay games have changed over the years. Mm-hmm. My personal feeling is that we have... I like precision in rules.
Right.
I like a rule, I read it, I know what the rule says.
Clarity, especially.
But I think we trust in rules too much these days.
Oh, yeah?
I think we do. I think there is, when I look at a role-playing game that's a 300-page rule book, mm-hmm. to me, that's, how many people who are role-playing today, if you put them back in a time machine and replace their first game with a 300-page rule book, would they be role-playing today?
There's certainly a barrier to entry there, and even just a perceived one.
I think it's an enormous barrier to entry. Yeah. I think you'd lose half your audience or more. I mean, this is kind of my little bully pulpit. This is what we're doing a lot, and we'll segue into the playtest next.
Right.
But I think that's something where our role-playing games in general, and now there are a lot of exceptions, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But especially for Dungeons & Dragons, which is supposed to be the frontispiece of gaming, it's where everyone starts. Really, how many people can start these days? Like, can just come into Dungeons & Dragons cold and figure it out?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a reason why we say commonly people come into D&D through their friends. They come in by playing the game with their friends. And so very few people that I've ever played with, you know, oh, new guy's going to be in the group. Great. Hand him the 300-page manual and tell him to read that, and then we'll play. No, yeah. It's usually just like, hey, come on, sit down. We'll play this game. And they talk you through it. They don't start they don't front load you right. with giant manual of rules.
But that's if you're lucky enough to have friends who sure. like play the game. How many sure. people out there, like, we only hear that because, like, we're the people who have made it through that barrier were the people who had friends there to pull them through. Mm-hmm. How many people aren't playing because they couldn't get through, sure. they didn't know where to start?
Sure.
I mean, it is very... it's something that I really think about a lot because yeah. I think when you look at role-playing as a hobby, I mean... The fundamental thing of its appeal hasn't changed and hasn't been replaced. I mean, there are parts of it that have been replaced. Like, you could say you could play an MMO, and if you just really want to, like, if you really enjoy leveling, you know, you can do that in a lot of different games.
Sure.
But a role-playing game, if you just to say, hey, all I'm going to tell you about this role-playing game that you're about to play is that you get to level up. Like, you'd be like, well, how many hours is this going to take? And do I really, is this really what I want to do, right? You could be, well, no, I'd rather spend my time doing
something
else.
How does grinding work in this pen yeah. and paper game?
Exactly, nah, that's right?
Not really, I mean, that'd be like leveling up is not an intrinsic part of what makes a role-playing game a role-playing yeah. game, right?
It's the interactions.
Right.
And it's the idea that it's people at the table. That's why we like to role-play with our friends.
Right.
I think about organized play and this idea of how do you get people to role-play with strangers. It's like, how do you get people to sit down and eat dinner with strangers, right? Like, there's a barrier there.
And it's an intimate thing.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this is the old saw in RPGs that it's not the system, it's the game master, the dungeon master, mm-hmm. the keeper, whatever right. you call it in your game. And I think that's true. I think at the end of the day, role-playing games are about people.
Yeah.
And it's about the people at the table. And when you think of the rules are really just there as a tool. And this is all stuff a lot of people would say, yeah, that's obvious. But I mean, when you're getting into it, the idea of a role-playing game, if you haven't played a tabletop one before,
right.
is so different and interesting that the concept alone and the people at the table are enough. You don't yeah. need all these meta rules and what about this and that and the design thing and what builder do you have? There's just so much, and it's just, yeah. it loses sight of what actually gets most people to sit down and start role-playing. And then 5-10 years later, you can talk about all the detailed stuff once you've been playing a lot and you're really into it.
Sure.
But I think we've lost that real entry piece. And clearly that's what we're trying to
right.
to address with Next.
Yeah, when you talk about product, sure, absolutely. And there's programs like, you know, D&D Encounters is a reason why we provide you with the pre-generated characters, right?
Yeah.
It's so that if someone walks up to the table, you can say, okay, here's your guy, and it's got a picture of a character on it, and you sit down and you play an adventure, right? We don't sit down and necessarily teach you the rules.
Yeah.
The important part is sit down and play quickly so that you can see what's awesome about role-playing games. Well, it's about hanging out with other people and having a, you know, great adventure and telling a fun story and unexpected things popping up and discovering the world. What's great about role-playing games isn't, you know, like, here's the rule book, right?
Yeah.
It's the experience. It's a very experiential game.
You could memorize all the rules and completely miss the point of the game.
Yeah.
You could know the rules inside and out, apply them flawlessly, and be the worst dungeon master on the planet.
Right.
You know, and that's the kind of secret, I think, to role-playing games, why they're actually interesting, why people still play them.
Right.
Why it took off in the 70s, like wildfire, right? Is when you exposed a group of people to role-playing, some chunk of them wanted to role play,
right?
You know, it's not the same as like a smartphone where just everyone wants a smartphone or whatever, but it's like there is a type of person who wants to use this type of game and play it.
Yeah, and it spawned all kinds of other games that are like that, right? I mean, you look at any kind of storytelling game or any kind of storytelling board game or even party games like Werewolf or whatever. Many of those did not exist at the time
oh, yeah.
that Gygax and Arneson were creating the original Dungeons & Dragons. So I think it definitely does tap into a need that people had in their entertainment, which is
yeah.
I want to experience something with my friends in a social setting that is creative and we're experiencing a story.
Exactly. And that's why I think when you look at the original White Box, if you haven't looked at the rules vary from sparse to very detailed to it's not really clear what the rules are trying to do. But again, it's easy to look back, but you know, we have experience how to look at it. But I think without that level of freedom, sparseness of rules in terms of what characters can do. Like fighters don't have attack powers. They just swing their sword.
Right.
Clerics don't have many spells. The wizard spell lists aren't very low. Magic user spell lists, sorry. There's no
rogues don't even exist yet.
They're not even there in the game yet. I think that is what let the game succeed.
Sure. Well, there's a reason why people still play OD&D to this day, right? Because they got an experience out of that they like, and they want to keep having that experience, right? Yeah. It's still, I mean, we maybe don't play that ourselves anymore, but there are plenty of people out there that are enjoying, you know, an OD&D experience because, like, whatever, we don't need the rules. We're here for
the role play.
The role playing. Yeah. We're here for, and even like the most, you know, we always think, like, I've talked a lot about story, right? But you think about a dungeon crawl, like, you know, we just have disposable characters in a dungeon crawl. Even in that situation, a story comes out of it, right?
Yeah.
What happens at the table is the story, right?
Exactly. And I think if you had more procedural rules in the first role-playing game, the first big commercial role-playing game, I'm sure someone out there is like, oh, there are other role-playing games. I'm sure there were.
Yeah.
But Dungeons & Dragons was the first as far as like culturally, you know,
sure,
that had an impact. That openness was the strength of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is the strength of the game form.
Yeah.
And I think you lose something when you get too worried about the rules and all that other stuff that comes with it. Which is maybe an interesting segue into the D&D Next playtest.
Now let's talk about rules.
Or really, and in some ways, we've talked about this with Next. If you were to, you know, if you look at the rules, like this is really one of the big things of the game is to create that transition point
right,
where someone can just buy a game called Dungeons and Dragons and start role playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where I go back to the lesson of the white box. That's what's really important for us is to make sure we have that out there, because I think role playing is a great hobby. I mean, obviously. It's my hobby.
Right. Yeah.
Not that I own it, but that's what I do. But it's a hobby that is it's worth spreading and it's worth sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
I was reading online, someone out coming here a couple weeks ago said, you know, some forum or some blog post, can't remember now which one it was, but it's like, what's the point of growing D&D? Who cares? Like, if you have, and this person wasn't acting like in an angry way, they're just wondering, right, if you have a gaming group, why does it matter to you that you want more people to role play? And I think just as people, as human beings, we're sort of hardwired to want to share things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we like this and we like knowing that other people out there like mm-hmm. it gives you a little confidence in thinking about it, but it also kind of gives you the sense of there's an enduring legacy to it. Like, mm-hmm. when you sit back and think, oh, what's the point of doing this? Well, you're part of something bigger.
Right.
People like being part of something bigger. And I think when you feel like something that you like is getting smaller, that it's not as enjoyable. Like, you kind of feel like, am I irrelevant? Is this important? Mm-hmm. Has this been diminished? And I think, you know, one of the things we look at with Next is saying, what can we do to grow it? What can we do to make sure we're driving in the right direction, that everyone who wants to play a tabletop role-playing game can. Everyone who wants to go on fantasy adventures in the Forgotten Realms can, you know, things like that.
Yeah. I think there's something really there's also an element of, I play games now, I have a gaming group now, but, you know, 10 years from now, are my kids going to have a gaming group to play with?
Yeah.
I mean, because obviously they're going to have me, because I'm going to teach my kids how to play D&D. But, you know, are they going to have people at their school that are going to know how to play? Or when they go off to college? Or even, hey, I got a new job and I'm moving across the country and leaving my game group behind. Oh, and I go there and there are people that play D&D there. It's funny. When we first moved to Seattle just over 6 years ago now, my girlfriend, who's now my fiance at the time, she asked me how it was that 2 weeks into moving from Tennessee to Seattle, I had already made two full gaming groups worth of friends and already had, you know, a weekly game, actually two weekly games, because I joined your weekly
That's
game
right.
as well, right? You know, basically 2 weeks in, I've already got two weekly games, and we've got all kinds of invitations to, you know, parties and hangouts and stuff like that. She asked me, how do you do that? I said, well, because I have a hobby that is inherently social,
yes,
right? And I have a hobby that, you know, I arrive out here and I can say, hey, I like D&D. And someone else says, I like D&D too. We should be friends, right?
It also helps you worked at Wizards of the Coast.
It does help that. But I mean, even in any new work environment where I knew, you know, a few people here, I knew people here via email, right? We didn't hang out very much, right? even then, I was able to basically jump right into a social scene because I had a common bond with them. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, go back to the sitting down at the table and having experiences. That's why D&D is so awesome, is because I can have those experiences with my gaming group. And then when I go somewhere else, those people have had similar experiences. And so we've had similar experiences together.
Yeah. So playtest update.
Yes, we should probably talk about that, actually.
So what's new? What do we got?
Wow. Okay, so internally, we're testing a lot of things that will soon be, I will say soon with the air quotes around it, soon be heading out into the wilds. We've been working a lot on the Paladin and the Ranger and the Druid. Those are sort of our three big focuses. We have some other things, like we've been working on a few of the other races and some revisions to the math behind the game, etc. But the big sort of content pieces are the Paladin, the Ranger, and the Druid. And it's funny because two of those classes, I would say, fell into place very, very easily. Like we immediately knew, what is this class going to do? Well, they're going to do exactly what they've always done. We're just going to make sure it all works together well. And even, you know, I say two of the three, I would say the Druid and the Paladin were probably the two easiest, where it's like, okay, we know what these guys are going to do. And then even the Ranger, very easy to say, what does this guy need to be able to do and adapt that quickly? Whereas, yeah. I mean, they're classes that have been very consistent over the years, right? And while, you know, you might look at, say, the third edition Druid and say, okay, wow, this guy was really, really powerful, we still wanted to be able to do the same kinds of things. So a lot of it was just like, okay, how do we do this in a way that works with the game that we have right now?
So those are the classes we're working on.
Yes.
What about now? I'll bring up a character class that might not actually be a class.
So since Jeremy's not here, you're doing this to me to put me on the spot.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right? It's my job.
Because usually you put Jeremy on the spot.
Yeah, I like putting Jeremy, but he's sick. He has the flu. So
it's true. He has the flu that I gave him, unfortunately.
So we're looking at, there are some classes that you will be able to play a character of that type and not necessarily have the character class name on your character sheet.
Okay.
Because one of the things we said back in the day was, we want you to be able to play all the, if it's appeared in a player's handbook, it's going to appear in this player's handbook.
Yep.
But
that was a goal. Right?
We're always careful not to say it's a character class.
Right.
Right. Because we knew that, and I'm going to use an example. I'm going to talk about the Warlord.
Okay.
Which is, can be a contentious subject, both internally and externally.
Yeah.
But when you look at the Warlord, so right now we're looking at the Warlord as a type of fighter. Is that correct?
That's one of the things we're experimenting with right now. Yeah. And it's a more complex issue, like you bring up, because the Warlord class in fourth edition is a dash of fighter, in that he was a very martial guy. He wore heavy armor. He used weapons. So there's a dash of fighter, and then there's a hefty sprinkling of healing.
Yeah, kind of the bard, really. Yeah. It's inspiring people.
Very, very bard-esque there. And then there's the I don't have a catch-all term for all of his other leadership abilities, but things like action granting and throwing out bonuses and buffs and things like that. Basically a heavy support role, I guess.
It's really,
I would say.
And tactically, like tactical.
Yeah, cunning. Tactical support, I think, is what I would say.
And it's tricky because the class is really, and it is not, it's really tricky with classes like the Warlord. And I think when we've looked at the system overall, we've run into this a few times. The class isn't really an expression of, like, a character in the world of D&D that we felt, hey, this guy needs a home. It was more, we have a system. We can make the system do this, so now we're going to do this. It's kind of like the genesis of the sorcerer in third edition, where it was just, here's a different way to use all the spells in the book. It wasn't really like, oh, here's a character who's always been in D&D in a prominent place that hasn't been expressed as a class yet.
Yeah, although I will say this, thinking back to the proto-warlord, the Marshal from third edition, the Marshal, I think, was an attempt to do something sort of tactical like that. But also, the leader character is something that, you know, you would say, okay, the party's leader is the person who's the most charismatic or something like that. Like there's always been kind of a vague archetype out there for the leader character.
But it
wasn't necessarily the guy who's the tactical guy.
Yeah, or it's not necessarily the guy who was in charge. Because I think most gaming groups would rebel at the idea of, oh, this guy is in charge of us. Like,
right.
I think that's why you like being adventurers. No one's the boss of me, right? Like, but yeah, so it's sort of interesting. So from what I can gather, like, you know, we're looking at the Warlord, we've basically decided, let's focus on the tactical cunning aspect, which would be something that would make sense in the fighter, because then you can also imagine building fighters with a dash of that without multi-classing. Right.
And that's the big thing too. You know, I said that the Warlord was kind of an amalgamation of those previous classes. If you look at, say, let's say we were to build a Warlord by itself, right? It would look a lot like the fighter in the early designs that we've done. And we have experimented with, okay, here's what the class would look like, and here's what the specialty would look like, et cetera. So we've been all over the place with this. But if you looked at it, it kind of looked a lot like the fighter, right? And it wanted to do a lot of the things that the fighter does, because the Warlord in fourth is a frontline leader. I mean, unless you take the you know, archer build from Martial Power 2 or whatever, yeah, right? He is a frontline guy. So he wanted to do a lot of the things that the frontline fighter did. So we're experimenting with a version of the fighter that, instead of choosing things that necessarily make your attacks better.
Yeah, your combat maneuvers.
Yeah, your own combat maneuvers better. Things that let you let other people do things or enhance the things that they do. Now, it's again, that's part of it, right? Because then there's also the healing aspect of it, which is a whole different kettle of fish.
And I think my big thing is, would you, in the world of Dungeons & Dragons, if you pictured a guy who was a cunning tactical leader, would you expect that guy to heal you?
I wouldn't expect him to automatically be the guy that heals me. But I could see that character who is more of a field medic type guy as
he
well.
He could be a healer.
Yeah, he could be. I'm not saying is.
In which and that's throughout the system, right? And we have a specialty that lets you pick up some healing abilities.
Yeah. We're going to want to continue to expand that.
But we don't expect the sergeant of the guard or the captain of the guard to heal down warriors, right? That's not the default. And I think that's kind of the thing and then if you just say, well, he can heal because he's this really inspiring presence, well, then you've just kind of described a bard. Because bards, the entire steel of the bard is they're inspiring and it's they're charismatic, and the bard is the guy with panache who onward, right? Like, that's the bard's deal, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a big part of the bard, I would say. I think there's some desire for when you're playing that leader character, to be able to say, all right, men, you know, fight on, and we're going to, be the guy leading the charge, right? To be William Wallace from Braveheart, right? Like, you want to be that guy, and that I would not describe a William Wallace type character as a bard. Yeah. So,
but you also wouldn't say he's a healer.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't. I wouldn't think of, like, if there's a guy who's been gutted, William Wallace, like, gets the guys to freak out and charge or moon the British.
Well.
But is he healing? If a guy's a broken arm, does William Wallace, like, I mean.
Well, William Wallace clearly went and, inspired the guy who got his hand cut off to keep fighting.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's that.
But his hand didn't grow back. Now I'm being a little too.
It was in a cutscene, obviously.
Yeah, it's a cutscene. Literally a cutscene. The cutscene and the uncut scene.
Yes. To bring it back to the Warlord, I think that there is a focus that we're trying to take. You know, we talk about the Warlord being in the fighter on being the tactical leader guy. And then I think that if you want to play very much the fourth edition Warlord, we should have a way for you to build that character.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Take the fighter, take the tactical leadery fighter and apply, a specialty or
healing specialty or something.
Yeah, a healer
specialty.
That's
just like the one piece that's just not quite
right.
There.
And again, we are continuing to, like I talked about, the three classes we're adding. We're going to continue to add feats and specialties and stuff like that until we get the right mix of things.
Yeah.
So I could see down the road, one of the things we might do is a different take on, the healer specialty that basically says, okay, I've got fighter, leadery guy, and I smack on this healer, ability, and now I'm getting warlordy.
Yeah, it's interesting because you could imagine any character could be an inspiring battlefield presence. Mm-hmm. That to some extent, just like we have, you can take a specialty and get some light arcane ability. You can take a specialty and take some divine ability. This is almost like this is our feat based bard type ability. Like, I am just really charismatic and I can inspire people through my words. And it's kind of bardic.
Yeah,
but I guess that's what it really comes back to, is it's a very bardic thing to be the guy. Like, there's a line between, and that's why I kind of like, between inspiration and tactical cunning. And I think where it settles for me is the fighter can be tactically cunning as a fighter. Like, that's something that's uniquely fighter. And that's what you've chosen to double down on. If you're, hey, I'm the inspiring figure, that feels like a bard to me. That's what the bard does.
Yeah, I think embracing the idea that the fighter is he is sort of the lord of battle, right? He is the guy that you want on the battlefield. that can manifest a couple of ways. It could be, you know, I'm just going to tear through the bad guys with my giant great axe, or it could be, you know, we want him here because he leads us and he shows us the right tactical options to take and stuff like that. I think that's a great expression of the fighter, in fact. And so, you know, seeing that combined with, you know, other, like, I could see us, you know, talk about a specialty that is inspiring and everything like that. I could see you building this fighter and then taking some of that specialty as well. Yeah. So if you want to really be the guy, like, yeah, okay, I liked warlords that, you know, gave out a lot of benefits and buffs and, you know, action granting and stuff like that. I could see that being very much in the inspiring guy specialty.
Yeah.
Right.
Inspiring guy.
I don't have a name for it yet, but, you know, that's okay. I've got that.
That might actually just be the leader specialty.
Yeah.
If we don't have a leader specialty already.
We do not.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. We kicked one around before, but yeah.
Like, we had talked about taking the roles from fourth and just making those specialties.
Yeah.
Like, so it's like,
oh, we have, I mean, we have a defender specialty now, which does a lot of very defendery things. Right. I think that's another sort of exciting thing that we're doing with our specialties is that I could take my cleric and give him the leader specialty once we have one, right?
Yeah.
Right now, you could take a cleric and give him the defender specialty, and he works great, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of those things where we have disentangled, you know, some of the things that we think of as what you do in the game from necessarily who you are in the world as much.
Yeah.
So I can definitely see you, you know, building your buff and action granting focused warlord with fighter, choosing the tactical options plus leader specialty, right? Or, you know, a mix of the two, right? Fighter with tactical options plus half of the leader specialty plus half of the healer specialty, right? I mean, that's, we want to be flexible here so that if you want to focus on healing, you can. If you want to focus on buffing and leadership, you can. If you want to do something totally different, you can, right? You could be the tactical guy that takes the defender specialty, right? And I think that's interesting too, because, you know, I get right in the thick of things and I protect my friends while they follow my tactical orders and stuff too. Yeah. I think there's something exciting there about this sort of hybrid approach as well.
Well, I think that's the big, if you ask me personally, what I think has been the big improvement to D&D over the years, going, hey, let's loop back to the white box to today, is I do, like, I believe that if you were to go back in time to, probably not 1981, I was six when I first was exposed to D&D, but I was a little bit younger and I really started to play D&D, like actually play it using, like, starting with the red box and going to AD&D. I think I would have seen, like, hey, I can customize my character, so I'm not just, you know, I can remember playing an elf fighter who just carried a bow. But I still wore plate mail because that was the best armor, even though part of me was like, well, that's a little lame. I kind of want a guy who's more of a outdoorsy guy, but it makes sense, and I don't want to get killed.
Right.
But being able to say, hey, in the latest iteration of D&D, whether it's, you know, third, fourth, and second had this with kits, but, you know, you can make a character and you can back that up with mechanics. I think that is a step forward for the game, because I think people like, especially when you've played a couple of campaigns, you like the idea of, I can make a really unique character.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big advantage of the tabletop game versus a digital game where, I mean, you can play even the most sandboxy kind of digital role-playing games, you're still restricted to what's on the slider in terms of what you decide to do. Whereas with D&D, like, we can present more feats. I mean, I don't want to flood the game, and I think that's something which is going to will probably be a big change for people once we actually start producing next products, is we really don't want to do a lot of mechanics. Mm-hmm. When we do mechanics, we want them to be important.
Right.
Like, we're not just making a new feat for the sake of making a new feat. And this kind of ties to the specialty and background thing.
Right.
We're doing it because, hey, there's a new character or a character that is not yet available in the system that we want to make possible.
Right.
We're not just going to, hey, we need 20 feats. It's and I think, again, it goes back to the specialty thing. It's not just a bunch of feats. It's there are three or four new types of characters you can build that the rules wouldn't let you do before.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I think that's big. And I think really when you look at, you know, you're talking about being able to back up your character idea with mechanics. My sort of idealized world, the world I want to live in that we're working towards, I think, right now in Next, is I can build a character that my idea for the character is backed up with the mechanics and does very satisfying things. And it does all those things in a way that gets completely out of the way of me during the game session, right?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, the objective in my mind is design game mechanics that do what you want them to do, and they do it so fluidly and easily that you kind of forget about it, right? And so it's more about, okay, what are we doing right now? What are we focusing on, you know, in the world, in the adventure? Oh, yeah, and I do all the awesome stuff that I wanted to be able to do seamlessly.
Exactly.
Right? That's my goal.
Well, that wraps up our podcast for this week. Thanks to Rodney for stopping by. Thanks for Chris Dupuy for being part of our earlier segments. And thanks, as usual, to Bart Carroll for pulling this all together and running all the technological end of things. I'm your host, Mike Merles. Well, I'm your host for this week. We'll see what happens with the next podcast. All right, good gaming, and talk to you next time.